Welcome to Song and Plants. My name is Carmen Porter. In this episode, I was joined by the Chili Chump to discuss all things capsicum. His website offers a plethora of chili resources to satisfy the needs and curiosities of heat-seeking gardeners. He offers a spicy cookbook, a seed store, growing videos, detailed articles, and amazing software for tracking, documenting, and organizing plantings. I hope you enjoy our conversation. So welcome to Song and Plants. Would you mind introducing yourself?
Hi, my name is Sean, also known as Chili Chump Online. And yeah, I've been growing chilies for a couple of decades now and decided to start a YouTube channel around about 2016, where I share my adventures in chili growing, making hot sauce, and also a bit of the techie stuff that I like to do as well around automation of the growing. But yeah, that's me.
So you say automation of the growing. What's your setup?
Some of it's quite complex. When I talk about automation, obviously, when I first started doing YouTube, I wasn't doing it full time and I had other jobs to be dealing with. And the only way I could do that is by automating some aspect of the growing, in particular the watering side of things. When the season gets fully underway, you obviously have quite a few plants. I have at the moment about 500-600 plants, and having to water them manually, that's a good few hours each, well, every second day or so during the height of the growing season. So being able to automate that was paramount. And yeah, I started building out some basic systems doing that when I first started growing in bigger numbers. But yeah, it's got a bit more complex than that recently. Built out some really interesting watering systems, but also controlling my fans, doing some things like temperature monitoring, humidity monitoring, optimizing when things are watered based on some machine learning algorithms that I built. And I built out a bit of software as well that allows other people to do similar things. It got a lot bigger than what I originally intended. Originally, it was just to help me out, to allow me to actually still live my life and not be watering 24/7. But it's turned into a bit more than that. And yeah, it's good fun. I'm quite a techie at heart. So that's kind of my background before getting into gardening. But it allows me to mix the two loves of my life.
And where are you located?
I'm in the UK. We moved about three years ago. We moved a bit further north than we used to be. We used to be just outside of London. The reason I mention this is because if you are living just outside of London, the last frost dates are a little bit earlier than when you go further north. So if you're going up more towards Scotland, which is kind of, you know, the direction I'm heading. So I'm middle of the country, what we call the Midlands. Yeah, 3 years ago, we did that move because I wanted more space. But it does mean that we have a bit of a later last frost date. And as you know, that obviously impacts your growing. So I think we have about 3 weeks later, which is quite weird because the UK is not a big place. But moving just as far north as I am now, it changes the whole game. And I had to learn things pretty much all over again, optimizing my strategies with growing and that sort of thing. Because obviously, chilies are not native to the UK or anywhere in our sort of hemisphere. But yeah, it was a shift, but it's the best move we made because we've got a nice big old spot here, about an acre of land, and I get to grow loads and loads of chilies.
Nice. Do you have to provide light?
Only in the beginning of the year. So at the moment, all my plants are started. I started the majority of my longer season plants and most of my super hots, the Chinens varieties, and I'm sure we'll get into the different species a little bit later. But the longer season plants, the ones that take about 120 to 160 days, I start those very early in the year, around about January, just after the 1st of Jan. And to do that, because again, we are in the middle of winter at that point, there's not enough light, but there's also not enough heat. So I'm having to use a heated grow space that I call my germinator. It's just a shed that I've converted with some lighting and some heating in there. And that's the only way you can really start if you want to get a good start to the season, because the last frost dates here are around about the end of April. I do have greenhouses, which means I can go out a little bit before those last frost dates, but that still means it's early April that I'm taking plants outside. And if I had to start my plants early April, there's no way I'd get the harvests I get. So starting a few months before, getting them to a point that they are starting to mature and they're ready to go into the final pots around about end of April, that's essential. And that means obviously growing them under grow lights in the beginning of the year. But once they're outside in the greenhouses after April time until October, November even, there's no need for any supplemental lights. So we just use the sunlight.
So when you're starting the seeds, are there any recommendations that you'd have for getting good germination other than having good seed?
Good seed is the first way to go. Too many times when I'm responding, I get a lot of people asking me questions, sending me emails and messages and asking, you know, oh, I'm battling to get my seeds to germinate. Most of the time it's because they are using bad quality stock, so seed that hasn't been dried properly, or maybe seed that's older than what the seed vendors are saying they are. But beyond that, some varieties can be a bit more challenging than others. So typically, if you're using something like jalapeno or cayenne, you know, some of the capsicum annuum varieties, those are a lot easier to germinate. Generally, you get about 5 or 6 days for them to germinate, and they're not too challenging. Some of the hotter varieties, some of the longer season ones like the capsicum chinense, they can take, you know, 12, 14 days. I wouldn't really go too far beyond that. Sometimes it can take longer. And some of the very rare ones can take up to a month, month and a half. It's quite difficult. But some tips to actually get them to germinate, just get some good seed stock. And typically the same way that we would germinate most seed varieties, keep them moist, keep them humid. So I use a dome, obviously, on a propagator, keep that covered. And then very important is the heat level. You need to be germinating at around about 28 degrees Celsius. That's what I germinate at. I think that's 82 Fahrenheit. But a minimum there is probably 20 degrees Celsius. You're not going to get very good germination if you don't sit at least 20 degrees Celsius, which is, again, around 68 Fahrenheit. But the 20 degrees Celsius, those are going to help with those easier varieties like the jalapeno, the cayenne, even peri peri or bird's eye, Thai chilies, that sort of thing. The other little trick that I use, I actually made a video about this fairly recently because, again, beginning of the season, I'm always reminding people some tips and tricks on getting some good germination rates, is to soak your seeds. So I soak them in a tea. So it'll be a just normal English black breakfast tea or chamomile tea as well. And the reason you're doing that is it has tannins within that tea. And the tannins is kind of an acid type of thing, and it helps to scarify the seeds. And what that means is scarifying, it's similar to what happens when a bird eats seeds. It goes through the digestive system and it'll break down the shell, so it'll soften the shell somewhat and allows the seeds to germinate a lot easier. By using black tea or chamomile tea, it has a similar sort of effect, and it softens the shells and it allows those seeds to come through. It helps from two ways. Number one, it's going to help you germinate a lot quicker and have better success with germination. But the other one is it avoids helmet head. That's probably most important. I don't know if you've grown chilies before, but one of the problems you have sometimes is the seed will germinate, but the shell of the seed will stick on the top of the cotyledons, the two little leaves that start out, and the shell won't come off. And if it stays on there too long, then the plant is going to die. Most of the time, the seed will end up being able to get the little cotyledons out and the shell will pop off. But when that doesn't happen, you're having to do that manually. And oftentimes, if you are trying to cut the top off, you're going to end up damaging it. But if you do soak it in tea, then it definitely helps out and it'll stop that from happening. It'll allow that seed shell to pop off a lot easier.
That's fantastic. Thank you. I'd never heard it called helmet head, but that's
it's just what I call it. I don't know. Somebody, other people might call it something different, but I call it helmet head. It's very annoying, especially when it's a seed that you really want to germinate. And then you've got that and it's like, okay, now what? Now I have to do some surgery on the thing to get it off.
So one little thing that I have definitely heard people talk about is if they don't have a proper lighting, like really good lighting, they'll end up with slightly leggy plants when you start early. Is there anything that you'd recommend for getting the plants ready to put out?
The good news is you don't need to spend a lot of money on this. Yes, there are tons of grow lights out there. Sorry about that. It's my puppy making lots of noise. So we have so many options today with LED grow lights. The problem is people rush out and they go buy these expensive LED grow lights, which are fantastic. However, most of the time they're way too strong for your plants. So the Vipar Spectra, the Mars Hydra, the Spider Farmer, those are some of the brands that I use quite frequently. And they make some fantastic lighting, but you're having to turn those lights way down or take them very far away from the canopy of your plants, else you're just going to burn the leaves because they are so strong. So what you can do instead of spending the money on these LED grow lights, you can use a standard light bulb, a compact fluorescent light bulb. I don't know if you can really get them too much these days, but the old helix sort of shaped light bulbs, they work fantastic. Get one that's in the daylight spectrum, so 6,500 Kelvin or, you know, down to maybe 5,000 Kelvin, not any warmer than that. When the light is too warm, you get too much of the red light coming through. That's not what you're looking for. You want the blue spectrum, which is the daylight, the white light. But you can use those bulbs and they work perfectly fine. In the beginning, when I first started growing, I would use T5 lighting. So the old shop lights, the round, long bulbs, they work fantastically. But again, those get a little bit more difficult to get hold of too much these days. And people tend to just go with the LEDs. Now, the benefits of these compact fluorescents and those T5 fluorescent bulbs is you can't overdo it. You can't damage your seedlings. You can have those lights directly on top of the canopy of your plants, so on the leaves themselves, like almost touching, and they won't cause any problems because they're not very hot, and also they're not putting out too much light. The problem is if you're going beyond that first month of growth where your plant now starts to really develop and you've got a far more mature plant, they need a lot more light. So at that point, that's when the LED lights really come into their own. But the problem is people buy one light and it's going to fix all their problems, and they use that from the very beginning, not realizing, hey, it doesn't look so bright to me, so I'll just turn it up, because the plants, obviously, they need a lot of light. And they end up giving it way too much light and it stresses the plant. So even if you don't see any physical damage, you might not see the crispy edges of the leaves, which sometimes happens. What will happen is your plants just won't grow. They'll be stressed and they'll just decide to not put out any more growth on the roots or on the leaves, and you won't understand why that's happening. So be careful of too much light. As much as, yes, you do need a lot of light and chili plants love light, too much is still a problem. So I did some tests. There's a video, if you really want to get into some nerdy detail about it, I did a video on this, and there's an article on my website as well where I'm talking in depth about the different types of lights and also going into details on the amount of lumens that are being produced, or lux. That's sort of how we measure light for humans' eyes. We measure it in lux. So when you buy a light bulb, it tells you, hey, this is a 300 lux or 300 lumen bulb. I did some tests on quite a few different bulbs, and I also tested it with the type of light reading that you'd get for what plants actually see in terms of the light. So it can get quite complex. There's a phrase called lumens are for humans, right? So lumens are what we know when we see a light bulb that I have above my head right now. That looks bright to me because those bulbs are manufactured to be bright for human eyes. But plants, they have a bit of a broader spectrum. So humans' eyes can see yellow very well. So there's a big focus on the yellow and even the green part of the light spectrum. Whereas plants don't really get affected too much by the green part of the light spectrum. They get very much affected by the blue and the red, which is on the two opposite ends of the spectrum. If you're looking at a light spectrum, the yellow is in the middle, and then on the two sides, blue towards the left, red towards the right. So to measure that, you're measuring PAR. PAR is basically what you'd be measuring the light spectrum on for plants themselves, because it takes into account the blue and the red part of the spectrum. If you're looking at it, how it's measuring it, it'll be more of a square box rather than a curve, which is what we see. So that article does go into a lot more detail about that, but it also helps you because PAR meters are very expensive. The one I had is like £700 or $700, whereas a normal lux meter probably costs about $20. So I measured these lights and compared what they would be on the PAR spectrum versus what they'd be on the LUX spectrum. So if you do want to measure how much light your plant needs, I've got a graph that shows you exactly how much it needs at each stage of growth. So nice complex answer to a very simple question, but yeah.
Well, just to interject, what is your website so that people can go check that out?
Chillichump.com, C-H-I-L-L-I-C-H-U-M-P.com.
And as always, I'll put the links in the show notes as well.
Sure.
So when they've got these beautiful little seedlings, but they need to get more light and then they need to get them ready to go outside, what would you suggest they do?
So again, it really depends on what you're going to be doing. So are you taking them outside or are you taking them to a greenhouse? It really depends on where you're living. Even in the UK, I've done lots of experiments on this, on planting chili plants directly in the ground, so not having any cover. And it's going to work. You'll be okay. You'll probably get a few chilies, but you're not going to get the type of harvest that you'll see on my YouTube channel, because there's two reasons. Number one is when they're outside in the elements, chili plants, they do not like to have wet roots. They like to be able to breathe through those roots. So if they're constantly wet, which is obviously in the UK, we get a lot of rain. When it's raining, and let's say it rains for an entire week, that plant has now spent a week with its roots sitting in water and is not going to enjoy that. By having it in a greenhouse or a polytunnel, you're able to control just how much water is getting to those roots, and you can dry them out in between watering cycles, and that's going to result in a far better plant. The other thing is the plants like to have warm roots. So if you're growing, especially in the early part of the season, April, May, and you plant directly in the ground, it might survive, but it's going to be sitting in the ground where above ground you may be at 20 degrees Celsius, but below ground it's sitting there at about 10 or 12 degrees Celsius, and that's just going to completely stunt the growth of the plant. So if you are going to be growing in a greenhouse, then I can give some advice there. If you get to a point where you've got some lovely seedlings and now you've had them in a nice cozy environment like I do in my grow shed, and it's in a perfectly warm environment, the temperature's never dipped too much, and it's getting artificial light, so it's not getting full sunlight yet. When you take it outside, then you're going to have to consider that the sunlight, it's putting out way more light than any grow light you can possibly buy. So you have to be careful on just how much light you're exposing it to. Now, there's two ways, again, to do that. The one way is the way I do it, which is the lazy way. You time it right so that you don't need to harden off your plants. You don't need to protect your plants when you take them outside. So when I put my plants outside in early April, I know the sun is still coming in very low in the horizon. It's not hitting me directly, and those plants aren't getting direct full sunshine for a long part of the day. So they're able to adjust a lot easier without me having to protect them. The second way, if you're not going to be lazy about it or you can't get them out that early in the season, then you do need to protect them. So you need to use some sort of sheet where you're protecting it, putting in a little bit of shade. So it's still getting some light, but for most of the day, you're still shading it somewhat. And that'll help the plants to adjust. And you'll need to gradually adjust how much sunlight it's getting per day. It'll take about 2 weeks to do it effectively. And that's why I said I prefer the lazy way, because when you have so many plants, I do not want to be moving them in and out of the sunshine all day. And I don't want to be shading them, shade cloth and things like that. But that's essentially what you'll need to do if you are putting them out into some strong sunshine. So if you do live in a place like Spain, or you're lucky, you know, in Africa, yes, you need to protect your plants. You're going to definitely need some shade cloth, but you're probably going to use shade cloth most of the year because the sunshine is just way too harsh for them.
You mentioned a couple of different species. Would you mind expanding upon what are the different species that we grow as chilies or hot peppers?
Sorry, yeah, I call them chilies, but I actually did a video on that as well. I got a few Americans upset with me because I said that peppers aren't actually peppers, they're chilies. So peppers, people call them peppers because there was a bit of a confusion way back when peppercorns were very expensive, and they found these spicy plants that, hey, well, this is kind of like pepper. And they brought them back to, I think it was Italy, and they said, hey, well, this is pepper. Right? Meanwhile, it was actually chilies. And that's kind of why they call them peppers. But anyway, I digress. So species, there are five of the most common species that we grow. And unless you are like me and get into the wilder side of chilies, then that's probably all you've ever seen. Most people that have never grown chilies before have probably only ever seen three types of chilies, three species. The most common is capsicum annuum, so A-N-N-U-U-M. And those are your jalapenos, your cayenne, quite a few other varieties. Most of your sweet peppers, so if you're talking about a bell pepper, those are going to be capsicum annuum as well. Then the second most common is the capsicum frutescens. And there's a little bit of debate about this, whether frutescens and annuum are actually the same species. But frutescens typically are your bird's eye, your peri-peri, so your African bird's eye, Thai chilies, things like that. I would describe a frutescens as being a plant where the fruits are pointing upwards, they point skywards, whereas annuum, they typically point downwards, right, or sideways. But there's some confusion there. People will confuse the two, and that's fine. It's not a problem. Then the other one that people are going to be familiar with are the hots, the real hot ones, and those are typically the capsicum chinens varieties. Not Chinese, chinens. These are things like habanero, scotch bonnets, and then some of the really super hot ones, Carolina Reapers, and then some of the more interesting ones that probably the layman hasn't really heard of, like the seven pot primo, the primatale, the chocolate jigsaw, you know, some of the real exotic stuff that is killer heat. Those are all going to be from the chinens family of chilies or species. And then the other two common ones, and these are the top five common, you can imagine there's at least 35 or so species that I could go through, but these are the most common. The next most common I would say is, and that's one of my favorites, is the capsicum pubescens, which is a beautiful chili. What makes this fairly unique is the seeds are black. So all chili seeds that you get, they're white seeds, right? Similar to tomato seeds. But the capsicum pubescens, they have black seeds. And I just love that. They look so cool. The other way that you can tell a capsicum pubescens, besides the seeds, is the fact that the leaves and the stems are all furry, hence the name capsicum pubescens. But they're all like a furry type texture. But they're one of my favorites. They have a good amount of heat. They're very thick fleshed most of the time. Things like the ricotta manzano is one of the varieties that are quite common in the capsicum pubescens. But this year I'm growing about six different capsicum pubescens. I'm trying to collect up more and more varieties. There's not a lot that I've been able to get hold of, but some of the more common ones are like the ricotta manzano, ricotta marlene is another very interesting one. And I've got a few others growing. They're very thick fleshed, very, very juicy and fruity, but they do have a bit of a kick to them as well. Then you've got the last one in the most common, which is the capsicum bacatum. So these are quite popular in South America. They call them the ahi varieties. One of the very common ones or very popular ones over the last maybe 5 years is the ahi lemon drop, which is yellow. It's got a good bit of spice and it's got almost a citrusy sort of flavor. Those are quite common because they look wonderful, but it's not one of my favorites really. But they look great. I mean, there's a ton of other ahi varieties and capsicum bacatum varieties out there. Tons and tons. They've got quite a unique flavor profile. Not my favorite flavor to work with because obviously I make hot sauces. I tend to work more with the annuum frutescens and chinens varieties. Just I prefer those flavors when we're making a hot sauce. But bacatum still, there's so many beautiful plants in that species. One of the nice things with that is also the flowers are purple. So this is what attracted me to chilies in the first place. I love growing things anyway, but chilies, obviously they taste great. They look awesome. There's so many, there's tens of thousands of varieties of chilies, but each of the flowers, they look different. Each of the species, they just look amazing. The capsicum pubescens also has purple flowers. It's stunning. There's just so much variety. You'll never run out of new varieties to grow. So it is a great hobby if you haven't done it. One of the first wild types, because there's quite a few different wild types out there. One of the first ones that I really wanted to grow, and I've never had success with it, is the capsicum galapagoens. And this is something that's native to the Galapagos Islands. And it's a stunning little chili, a tiny little fruit, but it's really difficult to get that thing to germinate. That will typically take about a month at least to germinate. And the problem is, if you have something sitting in a human environment for that long, the chances are you're probably going to make it rot before it actually germinates. So it's a bit of a balancing act. But that's one of the interesting ones. There's so many, plenty others that you can get into. The Chacoens, the Eximium, Flexua, some beautiful ones. And most of them are more in the wild varieties. And there's quite a community, a sub-community within the chili community that love to grow these wilder varieties. And it fascinates me. There's so much choice.
How do the wild varieties differ in terms of the fruit?
Most of them, ones that I've seen, they tend to be quite small fruit. Like I said, with the Galapagoens, they're tiny little round things, maybe about a quarter of an inch, maybe even smaller than that. They have some heat, and some of them, some interesting flavors as well. But yeah, it depends. Like I said, there's another 30 or so species out there, and they all have something a little bit different to them. But typically the ones that I've seen, the ones that I've grown before, Capsicum Exile is another one I've grown. I did that successfully, but those are also small, little, tiny fruit. Tons of seeds, which is never great when you have a small fruit, but they're interesting to look at more so than for me to use in a sauce, because again, I'm growing a ton of chilies. I'm not just growing them just to look at. I'm going to eat the things. So I like to grow the bigger varieties.
Would you say that there are differences in general flavor between the species, or is it more between cultivars?
Species is definitely, obviously I review these chilies on my YouTube channel, but I also sell seeds for quite a few different varieties. And one of them that I'm selling this year is, it's a Chinense variety. So it's a Chinense species, but it has no heat. So what's unique with this one is you get the flavor of a super hot chili, but no heat. Now, that's not really a good thing, because the Chinense species don't tend to taste fantastic. It's a very unique taste. I'll be able to tell you, even from the smell, I'll be able to tell you that it's a Chinense variety. So yeah, definitely between the different species, they have very unique flavor profiles and also spice profiles too. You obviously get heat from the Capsicum annuum species and also the Capsicum frutescens. If you've ever had a Thai chili, you'll know it's got some spice to it. But there we're talking maybe 50,000 to 100,000 Scoville in terms of the heat levels, compared to a Chinense, you know, some of these super hots like Carolina Reaper, 1.3 million Scoville. You know, the heat levels are drastically different, but the flavors are certainly very, very different. So my favorite chili is probably the Peri Peri. So it's an African bird's eye. I am from Africa. And the flavor of that, I would describe it as smoky and sweet, and it's got a good spice to it. The spice profile, it burns your lips and your tongue, but it also goes away very quickly. So it's a lot of heat very quickly, but then it goes away. Whereas quite a few of the Capsicum Chinens, they'll build. And again, even the different varieties within the Capsicum Chinens, they'll burn in different ways. Some will have an upfront burn on your tongue. Some will burn in the back of your throat. Some will burn the entire mouth. Some will take a while to build. Some will hit you very quickly. So yeah, they will have their own little intricacies, but you can typically tell which species it is by the smell, the flavor, and even the heat.
And certain ones can actually be crossbred as well.
Yeah, so that's one very cool thing about chilies, is they are very promiscuous. They, not in that way, but they...
Well, kind of.
Well, kind of, yeah. Number one, they can self-pollinate. And number two, they are promiscuous and they got no problem pollinating within the different species. Now, some species cross easier than others. Some you could probably cross, but you'd have to do some very specific things to get that to happen. So if you consider, if we take two Capsicum frutescens species of chilies and cross them, they're going to be highly fertile. The F1, the first generation, is likely going to be very fertile, and you're going to have no problem seeding that and creating a new variety. So let's say you want to cross a jalapeno with KN, right? You're going to cross those over, and they're most likely going to create a new variety of that species, and it'll, you know, it'll be quite interesting. You might get something unique. You might get something that reverts to whichever was the most, you know, the longest living gene. So if the jalapeno has been around for many, many generations, then that specific one is likely to come through in the genetics. But then when you get to the more interesting things is when you want to cross something like something from a Bactum species with a frutescens, right? That's not going to be easy, right? Your hybrids are going to germinate okay, so you'll be able to cross them. The hybrid, the combination of the two will likely germinate, but you're probably not going to have too much luck going into F2 or F3, so the next generations. But the big one that people try and do is the Chinense variety, so the super hots. They try and cross a super hot with something that's large, like a capsicum annuum and maybe a bell pepper. It's always the comment I get on my crossing videos is, hey, you know what you do? You just take a Carolina Reaper and cross with a bell pepper, and then you'll have a massive Carolina Reaper. It doesn't work that way, unfortunately. You might end up getting a very small bell pepper. You know, so it's a lot of fun, and it does take a lot of work because obviously F1 is easy enough, but then you have to then stabilize it, isolate it so that it doesn't cross again with something else. You got to make sure that it's going to pollinate itself. Like I said, they self-pollinate, so you can isolate them by using mesh bags, things like that, or put them in a location that they don't have access to any other pollen. And then you can self-pollinate these things, and then you have to grow it out over multiple generations. So it takes about 7 generations before you get to a point that they're going to be fully stable. And that means that from there onwards, you don't need to be very, very specific about isolating them. Those seeds that are going to be coming from those plants, they're likely to grow true. They'll have the same look and taste of the chili that came before it, the parent plant. But anything like F2, F3, F4, the likelihood is it's going to keep changing. And you might have something that looks a bit different, tastes a bit different. It might not grow very well, might not be very healthy. And that's where the challenge comes in, because you can't just grow one or two of these resulting seeds. You need to grow, you know, 50, 60 of them, and then decide which of those 50 or 60 have the traits that you're looking for. And then isolate those further, and then grow another 50 or 60 in the next generation, and keep doing that down multiple generations until you get to something that I'm happy with. This is exactly what I was looking for. The color, the look, the shape, the taste. And there you go. At F7, there you have a brand new variety. So it can be a little challenging to get it happening, but it is worth it when you now created a brand new variety of chili. So I do have a few. I don't know if you've come across that. I have a few that I've done. I have one that's at F5 right now. That was really challenging. And that was crossing a Bactum with a frutescens. So I mentioned before, peri peri is my favorite chili, and I have my own variety of peri peri that I've been selectively breeding for a while, the Chili Chump peri peri. And I crossed that with an Ihe lemon drop, which again, I mentioned earlier. So it's called the lemon peri, and it's at F5 this year, but it's been a real challenge to get that thing to, number one, to fruit. I can get a massive plant, a beautiful plant that looks amazing. The fruit that come off it, I love the shape of it, but I'm getting 3 or 4 fruit on this plant. Now, what I have to do is try and make it so that it's going to, you know, grow out. I'm going to grow out another 30 or 40 of them this year, maybe 50 of them, and then choose the plants that grow the most fruit and keep isolating it down until I get to a point that I've got a prolifically growing plant with a lot of fruit coming off it, but with the unique traits that I've been looking for and the taste, which is kind of a sweet taste, the citrusy taste mixed with that smoky, spicy, sweet taste of the peri-peri. So it's challenging, but it's a lot of fun, very rewarding.
I'm a little curious because I know that when you are crossing stable varieties, so within the same species, when you make your F1, you'll get mostly dominant traits that are going to be coming out. But then when you plant out those seeds, you're going to get a lot of recessive genes manifesting. So you have to plant a lot of them and then select plants from that and then continue down the line if you're dealing with a self-pollinating plant. I guess what I'm wondering is, when you're going cross species, are the challenges different?
There was a study done back in, I think, 1986, the original study that I read about, and it talks about some of the more common varieties. I think there's 12 species that they worked with. and they did the crossing between the male and the female parent, and they worked out which were going to germinate normally, which ones would be partially fertile, which ones would be highly fertile. So the one that I crossed is the frutescens and the Bacton. It says there that the hybrids germinate normally, so that's fine. But beyond that, that's where the challenge comes in, right? Because your first F1, it's fine and it's going to be great. But then after that, that's where you have problems. I remember when I tried F2 of that specific species, it took me about 150 seeds to get 4 to actually germinate. And I ended up having to keep doing that. And that's why it's taken so long. I started this project quite a few years ago. It's quite challenging. But yeah, there are different challenges when you're crossing between different species. If you're crossing within the same species, that's easy. That's fairly easy. You've still got a lot of work to do because you're going to have to, like you've said, grow out many, many different plants to try and get the traits that you're looking for and hope that you don't get any recessive genes popping in, some of the stronger genes coming in from one of the parents. But so yeah, it's when you start crossing between species, that's where it gets pretty difficult.
So I guess viability is something to overcome when you're going cross species.
Viability, the health of it as well. What I've found, I've got about 12 different crosses that I'm working with at the moment. There's a few that I actually sell at my store. I've crossed a few Chinense varieties with each other and come out with some very interesting stuff. Those I see as fairly easy to do. It's still a lot of work and you have to really be careful with it. But some of the others that I've tried, I'm getting nowhere with it because the fertility of it. I have these seeds that look beautiful and healthy, but getting them to even germinate, it's not happening, right? That's some of the challenges that I face with the crossing piece. But it's something, as long as you go into it understanding that you're not going to just, hey, I'm going to take this flower, take that flower, squish them together, and now we're going to get new species. As long as you're not going to think like that, then you should be okay. As long as you understand that there is a challenge to it. It makes it more worthwhile when you actually do get something interesting.
And I imagine because there are so many different species and even varieties within the species, stable varieties within each species, you have a lot to work with. There's a lot of different flavors. There's a lot of different shapes, even if you are just going to be crossing varieties within one species.
Absolutely. The challenge that I've found is I don't necessarily trust that the seeds that I've purchased in the past are isolated or stable. So, you know, even though you might grow it out and, hey, I've got exactly what I was told it's going to be, when you try and grow it out the second season, if you save seeds from it, the chances are you're probably going to get something that's a little bit different than what you originally had. So you have to then isolate. Before you even get to the point of wanting to cross your different varieties, you need to make sure they're fully stable and isolated. So most of the time I'm buying seeds, I have certain suppliers that will help me out with this, and they'll be quite candid with whether it is isolated or not, so it helps me out. But otherwise I treat it as if it's F1, and I will grow it out for 7 generations. Now you can do multiple generations in a year, but typically a generation happens once a year. So that's 7 years just to get your plants to a stable position. Once they're in a stable position, then you start doing the crossing. Because if you're using an unstable variety to then make a cross, it's unstable with its two parents. So now you might have recessive genes coming in from two different parents that you're now trying to cross with another variety. Which one is actually going to come through if you have something specific in mind? So you can do it if you just want to have a go and see what you're going to get from a cross and you're not too bothered by the parents or what the end result might be, then that's fine. Go ahead and, you know, do that cross. But if you are looking for something very specific, maybe it's, I want a plant that is going to grow massive, be very healthy, it's going to germinate very quickly, and I, at the end, want the fruit to look a certain way, and I want the flowers to look a certain way, then I'm going to be very specific about which varieties I'm using to cross to get that. If you're not bothered by that and you just want to make a new variety and it's going to be fun, then yeah, you can go ahead and do that.
Have you found particular traits that are dominant within the different species?
Not really. It's more down to the varieties. I've been isolating, you know, selectively breeding my CC Periperi, for example, the Chili Chump Periperi, to be something that has all the qualities that I need. Number one, I had to choose a variety that had chilies that were bigger, because Periperi tend to be quite small. We're talking about like an inch, maybe half an inch even sometimes. And harvesting those smaller pods is a bit of a pain. So if you are making sauce from these things, you want bigger pods, but you want to maintain the taste and the heat of the smaller pods. So selectively breeding to get bigger pods, that was one of my initial things that I was looking for. And then secondly, it was for the size of the plant, so how prolific it was going to be. And then after that, well, I mean, I'm looking for all these things at the same time. So I keep track of all these things. The app that I mentioned right in the beginning, it's Seedzio. It's anybody can use. It's not just for chili growers. Seedsio.com. And basically, it helps you to track your germination rates and things like that. So I can keep track of all the plants growing out the peri-peri. I would know this plant here took 4.5 days for me to germinate. So that's great. I love that. These ones here, 7 days, 8 days. Yes, the fruit are nice, but it took a lot longer to germinate. So I want the ones that can germinate quicker. Then I want the plants that have a bigger yield. So if I'm getting 3 kilograms of chilies off a specific plant versus this one over here is only 1.5 kilograms, then I know that I want to save the seeds from that specific plant. And you keep on doing that over and over again, and you keep on isolating it to a point that now I've got a plant that every year I'm going to get that same quality. I'm going to get the same virility from the germination. I'm going to have easy fruit setting, and I'm going to have a delicious fruit that's going to be the size that I want. That's kind of what you're aiming for, but it's keeping track of everything as you're doing this. That's where the real challenge comes in. Some plants are bigger than others. Some will grow into monsters. So some of the Capsicum chinense varieties, some of them grow very small, so it'd be like a small bush. But things like the Naga Moric, it's a classic. I absolutely love that chili. It grows massive, very hot chilies. It's not the hottest in the world, but it's massive chilies. You typically get a very large tree pretty much from this plant. And in a single season, you'd have tons and tons of fruit coming off it. Now, crossing that with something else. So one of the crosses I've done is between a Naga Moric and a Viper. So a Naga Viper. It's because I like more heat, but I want the size plant that the Naga Moric puts out. So yeah, it definitely, it's not down to species necessarily. Yes, some species like Bacatums can grow massive. You can get 4 or 5 meter high Bacatum. There's a friend of mine in Finland. He runs Fatali Seeds. So he calls himself Jukka Fatali. And he grows these monster Bacatum plants that it's unbelievable. Every year I see his growth and it's amazing to me. But those things can grow huge. So you can imagine you might want to cross a Bacatum with something like my peri-peri because, again, I want these massive plants. Unfortunately, the plant size is more the size of my peri-peri rather than the Bacatum, that lemon peri that I'm growing. But yeah, different species, they do have certain traits, but within the species, there's so many different varieties that they can make such a difference in terms of the yield and size of the plant, the health of the plant, germination rates, things like that.
So you've mentioned a couple of different of your favorite varieties, but would you mind talking about a few other recommended varieties?
Sure. Another favorite is something I recommend to people that maybe aren't too interested in the hotter stuff. One of the most tasty ones out there are the Pepperjew. Now, this is something that many people have had access to. So in the shops, I don't know if you can get them over where you are, but it's very popular here in the shops, Pepperjew, pickled Pepperjews. They're like little round pods and it's like a sweet pickle. So I have a recipe on my website, which on my YouTube channel, actually, to show you exactly how to make the exact stuff that I'm talking about. It's a sweet pickle and it is delicious, but these chilies are just perfect for it. They grow abundantly and they grow into massive plants. So if you are wanting to start out with growing chilies, number one, peri-peri is obviously great because if you like peri-peri chicken, Nando's and things like that, then you can make some awesome stuff with that. And it makes great sauces as well. But the Pepperjew, or otherwise known as the Malawian Piquant, those are amazing because they're just so sweet. They have a bit of spice, so enough to, you know, let you know that it's there. But when you pickle them in this way, it's just delicious. And also you can stuff them with cheese and things like that. And then there's obviously the classics like the jalapeno. Every year I grow many, many jalapeno plants. You can imagine, I mean, I have access to so many different varieties of chilies, but I still grow some of the classics like that because it's a classic for a reason. It tastes great. It's versatile. It's good in the sauce. It's good on the barbecue, wrapped in bacon, stuffed with cheese. I mean, there's so many different ways you can have it. And it does make fantastic sauce. So a lot of people don't know, like jalapeno, they think it's just green, right? That's how it grows. And then you end up with a green pod. It's not ripe. Jalapenos go red. And that's so if, you know, I get that question quite a lot. It's like, hey, my jalapeno is changing color. I think there's something wrong with it. I'm like, no, it's just ripening. So sriracha is made with jalapeno, ripe jalapenos. And they're also made with serranos. So it's another classic as well. But those are some great varieties to grow. They're fairly easy. They germinate quite quickly and you won't have too many problems with them. The season is fairly short. So even if you are living in a place like I am and you don't have a greenhouse and you want to grow on a windowsill or something like that, then those are good options. But a lot of beginners, they'll end up rushing over to the super hots, like the scary sounding ones. I understand why. I love growing them. But the problem is they need a long season and they get very disappointed and very disheartened when they start them in April, because sometimes on the seed labels, it says, hey, you can start these in April. That's great. But by October, November, you still haven't got any pods or any ripe pods. It's going to make you feel very despondent about things. So those ones can be a bit more challenging.
So you touched on a couple things that I'd be curious to elaborate upon. One is the preparation. So what are some recipes that you would recommend?
So I'm a big supporter of fermentation of chilies. So a lot of people don't really know that most of your most favorite sauces out there are actually fermented. They might not say fermented because fermenting, it's kind of a scary word for some people. It makes you think something is rotten or whatever. So a lot of these brands will say it's aged chilies, which just means fermented. It's a natural process that uses a naturally occurring bacteria that's on the chilies themselves to actually process them into something that is a little bit more acidic. So lactobacillus is the bacteria that's on the chilies. It's the same bacteria that's on cabbage. So if you're making sauerkraut, it's the same stuff that you use to make sauerkraut. It changes the flavor of a chili so much. And the sauces I make with my fermented chilies, I far prefer to anything else because it mellows out the green taste. There's kind of a green taste to chilies. That's the way I describe it, green taste. And you'll know when you try it, but it's a bit more of a harsh taste, like eating leaves a little bit. I'm not selling this. But when you're fermenting it, it mellows out the flavors. The flavors all come together. It sort of evens out the peaks of some of the harsher flavors that are there. The heat level is still there. A lot of people think that fermenting, it actually reduces the heat level. It doesn't really. It might seem like it just because the rest of the flavors all come together and like supplement the heat. But if you're fermenting a super hot chili and you try that, believe me, you're still going to have a lot of heat coming through. So fermenting is one way that I love to prepare my chilies. What's great with that as well is you get an abundance of fruit late in the season and you can't necessarily use them all at the same time. So by fermenting them, it allows you to make sauce throughout the year. So I have buckets and buckets of fermenting chilies right now for my sauce business. They're all ready to go. And when I need to make new bottles of sauce, I can then process it from these batches. Yes, you can freeze them, but that's a bit of a different ballgame.
Do you salt them? Are they in a brine or?
Yeah. So there's two different ways that I do it, kind of three ways, but two main ways. There's a brine fermentation. So that's where you're adding salt to water, typically at about 2.5 to 3% ratio. So 2.5% by weight, the salt to the water. And then you're rough chopping up your chilies, covering them over with this brine, and then sealing it up. I use airlocks, similar to if you do home brewing, then you'd use these little airlocks. I like to use it that way. I see some people saying you can use like a mesh cloth over the top and not seal it, but I'm not a fan of that because it's not as foolproof as the way that I do it. So that's one way of doing it. The other way is a mash fermentation where you don't add water. This works better for juicier chilies. So you'd basically blend up the chilies with a 2.5 to 3% weight of salt to the chilies. So you'll weigh out all your ingredients that you're going to ferment. And then you measure out the salt as 2.5 or 3%, depending on how you want to go. But 2.5, I would say, is the minimum. And then you measure out that salt, mix it in, blend it up, and again, seal it and let it go. At least 3 weeks, let it ferment at temperatures of around 68 Fahrenheit or 20 degrees Celsius. And by the end of that, you'll have a nice fermented chili mash or chili fermentation. Then you process it into your sauce. You can do so many different things. And this is, again, where you probably want to go to my YouTube channel. I have probably about 40 or 50 different recipes up on my channel. On my website, I've got a bunch more, and I've got a recipe book as well that's got a few in there. But there's different ingredients you can add. You can keep it simple. Have you had Cholula before? Cholula hot sauce? So that's a fermented hot sauce. That they use fermented chilies in there. I believe it's fermented cayenne, if I remember correctly. And they keep it very simple. They add in some vinegar, there's some salt, and there's chilies. That's it. Tabasco, same thing. Tabasco is fermented chilies. Tabasco use a lot more vinegar, but they ferment their chilies for about 3 years, 4 years. So you can go that long. The longest I've done is 3 years, but 3 weeks is the very minimum. I would normally recommend a month and a half, 2 months, and then you can use it. But you can keep it for a lot longer than that, obviously. But Tabasco, they do about, it's about 70% of the ingredient is vinegar. So they add vinegar after, which is why it is so watery and vinegary. But most of your big brands, Sriracha is fermented. Who else? Frank's. Frank's is definitely fermented. Frank's uses cayenne as well. Frank's is straightforward. It's probably the type of vinegar they use is what changes the flavor a little bit. But other than that, there's no other ingredients in there. But if you do want to start playing with ingredients, some of the ones I like to use, especially when you're doing hotter chilies, so ones that can be a bit more overbearing, you want to get that balance right, you need to use stronger other ingredients. So garlic is obviously a good one. Garlic works great. So you can add that in there, blend it in with your sauce. One that I like to use as well is cardamom. If you have got an extremely hot chili, something like the Carolina Reaper or Seven Pot Primo, something like that, and you're making a sauce from it, if you go and add something subtle, you're not going to taste it because the heat is just going to overwhelm you. So you need something that's going to be strong. So green cardamom, I like to use that, roasted green cardamom, blend that up into your sauce, and that really brings out some amazing flavors. And there's some other great ones. Cumin is great. You know, a lot of the Indian spices, they work really well with this. Ginger, always a good one. But that's, again, it's quite subtle in my mind. If there's something missing and I'm battling to get past the heat of something, and I need to get some flavor in there, then cardamom is normally one of the things I'll start playing with. But yeah, there's so many different ways to prepare it. That's just the sauce side of things. Then you've got the other side, pickling. Pickled chilies are amazing, but doing it is so, so easy. Again, I have some very simple recipes on my channel which will help you with pickling. And there's the sweet pickling that I do with the pepper juice, the Milan Piquant, and those are great. You can do it with many different chilies. Milan Piquant is one of them that are particularly nice. Pickled jalapenos are always good, sliced pickled jalapenos. I put those into salads and, well, into most meals. Chili con carne, I'd go and stick it in there as well. So pickling is fantastic. And then, yeah, the other way is every year we have lots of barbecues. I'm South African, so barbecues or braaiing, what we call a barbecue, that's like our life. But every time spring, summer comes along, I am doing my stuffed jalapenos. So what we call jalapeno poppers. Basically, you slice it in half, take out the seeds, and stuff it full of Philadelphia cream cheese, and then wrap it in bacon, and then barbecue it. And it's awesome. It tastes so good. So yeah, there's so many different ways to prepare them. And then the obvious way, which is just chop them up into whatever you're making. Making a bolognese, throw in some chilies, make it taste nice and spicy. Or chili con carne, it's always good.
Well, a quick little interjection there, if you're chopping them. So do you have any remedies for the burn?
Yeah, gloves. No. So again, I'm processing chilies, especially when it gets to around August, September, October. I am processing chilies daily, and I use latex gloves, but I'm still burning because some of the hotter stuff that I use, even when it aerates, and if I'm sweating and it happens to stick to my skin, I'll feel that burn for the next few hours. There's no way around it, really. So you just kind of get used to it, enjoy the tingle. But yeah, I mean, there's obviously some remedies if you are eating some hot stuff. If you're going to eat a hot chili and you want to try and cool that down, milk, fine, but there's better things than milk. Milk, you'll end up just drinking way too much and make yourself sick. A bit of ice cream will solve it if it's a really hot one. Anything that's kind of greasy, try and eat that before, because it's not the burn initially that's the problem, because that normally goes away after about 10 minutes, the burn in your mouth. The problem is when it gets into your stomach, and it's not, I'm not going to get too graphic here, but it's not about what comes out of the other end. It's actually the process of your body digesting it. It can give you such serious cramps. That's my biggest problem, because I eat these super hot chilies to figure out the flavors and how I'm going to use them in sauces. My biggest problem is not the heat in the mouth. I can get through that. It's the next 2-3 hours while it's going in your digestion system. Your body is detecting that capsaicin, the hot stuff that's in the chili, and you get such severe cramps. So anything you can do to avoid that, that's hugely beneficial. That's normally where I'll drink something like a milkshake before or something like that, just so it layers your stomach. But in terms of your hands, yeah, wear gloves. That's the only real way. There's no other way to do it. And if you do happen to get it on your hands, be careful of where else you're going to put your hands.
So the capsaicin is fat soluble, right?
Yeah.
So that's why no water.
Water is going to do the same as milk, really. It cools your mouth down while it's in your mouth, but then it's going to feel even hotter once you've swallowed the water. So that's why milk kind of helps. It will kind of break it down a little bit, but it doesn't matter. When you're going to some of the more extreme chilies, it doesn't matter what you put in your mouth. It's going to hurt. But yeah, if you're doing things like the peri-peris, then just eat something. Eat some cheese. That's a good one. Some cream cheese or some cottage cheese. Anything like that to just cool your mouth down for a while. Yogurt's good. Yeah.
So you mentioned that some of them require a longer season. I have heard of people overwintering their plants. Is that something that can help?
Absolutely. You get a nice early start, but it can also present its own challenges. So I've done some experiments with overwintering. I think certain species, certain varieties are more adept to being overwintered. I tried overwintering my jalapeno plants because I wanted some nice early jalapeno poppers on the barbecue. And I did. I got some early fruit, but they had no heat. So even though it's the same plant, the second year of growing and the third year of growing, I found that it changed the heat level of these chilies. So that didn't really work out too well. With some of the super hot, so Capsicum chinense varieties, they seem to do quite well, especially because of the fact that they take such a long time anyway to set fruit. So if you are someone that has started at one of the super hots or something like a habanero, for example, and you started that in April, May, you might not have fruit that first year. That's not a problem. You can overwinter it. So trim it right back and get rid of a lot of the leaves. So there's only a few leaves on there. Clean out the soil and clean off the roots. Put in some fresh soil and keep it indoors somewhere warm. You don't necessarily need any light or anything like that because you want it to go dormant. And then just lightly water it maybe once every 2 weeks or so. And when it comes to the next April and you're ready to take it outside, you're going to get an early head start. So that's what overwintering really is. But it is important not to overwater, because that's what a lot of people do. They think, well, it's growing. I need to give water, right? It looks dry. But yeah, all that's going to do is just sitting there with wet roots because it's not actively going to be sucking up that water. So yeah, overwintering does work with some varieties, but I don't do it myself too much. Number one, I really enjoy growing from seed. I love that whole process, starting off from seed and seeing them grow. And you know, if you time it all right, then you're fine. I get good harvest, so it's all good. And the second reason is some varieties, I just don't get the quality of the chilies that I'm expecting or wanting when we get to, you know, the second year, third year. And also some varieties, they don't do very well in terms of overwintering too many times. So the first 3 years typically is when the plant is going to be producing the best. After that, it's not going to produce as much. I found that to be pretty much most varieties are like that.
Just one last thing is seed saving. So you mentioned you like growing from seed. If somebody wants to save their own seed, they're only growing one variety. They are self-fertile. I guess that would mean you wouldn't have to bag them. I guess if they have two varieties, they might need to bag. Like, what would you suggest to be good seed saving practices if it's not a hybrid?
If it's not a hybrid, if it's an heirloom or if it's something that is considered stable, some of the less exotic type of chilies, you know, like jalapeno or cayenne, if you're growing something like that, or Scotch bonnet, and you happen to know that it's good seed stock, good seed source that you've started with, then take a chance. It's not going to be a problem. Save the seeds from your healthiest pods and grow them on the next year. If you want to be very specific about what's going to come through and be very certain of making sure that it's exactly the right variety, it's the same as what I've grown this year, then you're going to need to isolate. So a flower, a chili flower, can pollinate itself. So it's not just the plant pollinating itself, it's the actual flower can pollinate itself. So the pollen that's produced by that individual flower can then pollinate itself, which is why we use things like favor bags. There's something called organza favor bags. They're like little mesh bags that you can buy quite cheap on eBay. Cover over the flower before it opens up, and that'll stop bees and other insects coming along and pollinating it with potentially pollen from another plant, which then means you could have some sort of hybrid growing. So that's only if you want to be very specific, like I want to make sure that I get this exact Scotch bonnet next year. I want it to be that color. I want it to be that flavor. I want it to be the same type of plant. You're going to need to isolate. Otherwise, you're just taking a little bit of a risk. Most of the time, you'll be perfectly fine, especially if it is something that is a fairly stable variety, because the genes are going to dominate and it's going to take over. So if something else has tried to pollinate with it, then it doesn't really matter too much. You might get something a little bit different, but by F2, it's going to be back to what it was before.
And is there anything for seed storage?
You've got to dry it first properly. And yeah, it's the same as with most seed storage. Just make sure you're drying it properly, not drying it at too high a heat. So obviously for my seed store, I dry things very slowly. I simulate drying in the sun, so I won't exceed 30 degrees Celsius. And I will then do that for quite a while, and I'll make sure that my humidity levels are set to a specific humidity level. At that point, you can then seal it in a bag. Now, if you don't dry it properly and you seal it in the bag, you're going to end up getting fungus or some sort of growth on there, and it's going to kill your seed. So that's not good. The other thing is, as well, anything that I want to keep beyond a year, I'll store it in the fridge. You can't do that if the seeds haven't dried sufficiently, because you can also store them in a freezer. And again, if you do that and they aren't dried sufficiently, you're just going to break the seed. So you can store it as you would any other seed, just in the dark, in a space that's going to be fairly dry, and you'll be perfectly fine. But just make sure that you prepared them right in the first place, right?
So just quickly, would you mind running through some of the connections where people can find your YouTube channel,
Sure. Your
all your stuff? What's the name of your book? That kind of thing.
So I have a little bit of a tagline at the end of my videos, which I say, stay spicy. And that's what I named my first recipe book. So Stay Spicy, the recipe book. But that you can only buy really on my website, chilichump.com. So chillichump.com. I also have my seed store, which is chilichumpseeds.com, but you can get that link from my main website. So most of my links will be on my main website if you don't want to remember all of these. And YouTube, of course, just search Chili Chump and you'll see a big bearded man showing off his lovely chili plants. But that's on YouTube, youtube.com/chilichump, and you'll find me there. But I release videos most weeks. Slow down a little bit at the moment because obviously running multiple businesses and coding Seedzio, that's taking a lot of time these days. But you'll see at least a few videos every month. And then also hope to see you on the next one, actually. My live stream, I do a live stream on the first Sunday of every month at 5 p.m. GMT. And that's good fun. People get to ask questions. And if they're having problems with their plants or if they got some problems making their hot sauces, then they normally ask me questions there. And it's a good bit of time I get to spend with my viewers.
Yeah, it seems that chilies do have quite a community.
Yeah, it is. It's because there's so many aspects to it. It is a massive community. When I first started out, it was about, I've been growing chilies since I was very, very young, but not on purpose, right? Back in South Africa, we had a few peri-peri plants, but it was just in the garden growing wild. Didn't have to do too much to make them do their thing. But when I came over to the UK, obviously you have to do it on purpose if you're going to grow some chilies. And I think it was about 2006 when I started doing this. And even back then, the community was massive and it's very passionate. It used to be quite male dominated, and these days less so, which is awesome to see. We have the Chili Queen, the UK Chili Queen. She's amazing. She can eat some hot stuff that I'll never, ever replicate ever. But yeah, there's some awesome people in the community, and there's so many different areas of it. Like I said, the source side, the growing side. We've got subsections of it, like these guys that are growing the wild chilies. It's good fun. And I'd say 99% of the community are just friendly, wanting to help, sharing the love of chilies. As always, you're going to get a small percentage of people that have something to prove, but I think you're going to get that in any community. I think the tomato community is probably even bigger. I was quite amazed by that because obviously I've never really been into that side of things, but I do grow some tomatoes because I use them in some of my sauces. And when you start jumping onto some of the forums and you look online at some of the YouTube channels, it's like, wow, I think this community might be even bigger than the chili community. It's just, they got tons of varieties. Though. It's a bit different. It's a little bit different. Yeah. less people trying to kill themselves with heat.
Well, thank you very much for joining me. It was really great speaking to you.
No, it's my pleasure. I hope I didn't talk too much. I do go on a bit of a tangent when I talk about chilies because there's just so much going on. And honestly, I'm so passionate about it. I love everything to do with chilies. Yeah, it's an exciting hobby. And it's awesome to see other people getting involved in it as well, especially younger people. So if any of you that are listening are wanting to get involved with chilies and you want some help, you can send me some messages on my YouTube or on my website and I'm happy to help.
Thanks for listening. As always, the links are in the show notes. If you're enjoying the podcast, please leave a 5-star review or share it with a fellow plant lover. I deeply appreciate your support and love hearing from you. Happy gardening.